Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, senators are debating a key mental health bill this afternoon. We'll talk to one of the co-authors from Beacon Hill. A new center that could change how Beacon Hill does business by providing neutral cost estimates for bills and ballot questions.
So it happens all too often that legislators just don't have the time or resources to really understand the stakes of the bills they're trying to write and vote on. And so an organization like this, ideally, would get that research into people's hands and improve policy.
Broker fees for renters. Should we eliminate them? Call us. 1-800-423-8255. And NPR's Steve Inskeep on America's original celebrity influencers.
In the process of making the West more enticing and more famous, he made himself famous.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Massachusetts Senate is debating legislation this afternoon on mental health with a vote expected at some point this evening. The bill is called the Mental Health ABC Act, and joining us now to talk more about it is one of the bill's co-authors, State Senator Julian Sear. He's also the Senate chair of the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use, and Recovery. Senator Sear, thanks for stepping out to join Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
All right, so this legislation is being debated basically now. So before we get into the details, where does it stand? Are you still debating, and do you, in fact, still expect a vote today?
We're in the midst of a debate. There's a actually a debate going on right now about the issue of emergency department boarding, and I expect that we will have a vote later this evening. Given the tenor of the debate, I expect it's going to be a very strong favorable vote, if not unanimous.
Okay, so Senator Sear, Massachusetts passed a law to ensure mental health parity 20 years ago. Why is it necessary to have this bill and have it now?
So I think where I want to start in talking about this bill is that, you know, the Senate president and I and other colleagues have really been, you know, framing this legislation in the context of our own experiences with mental health, both personally and with our families. I've struggled with anxiety and depression since adolescence. From an early age, people knew I was different, especially in school. But therapy really helped me manage my anxiety and do things I never dreamed I could. Yet I still can't get health insurance to cover my outpatient mental health care. Now, I'm a pretty savvy consumer. I'm a 34-year-old state senator, so I know how to navigate systems and bureaucracies. If I can't, you know, navigate through the barriers to accessing care in this broken system, imagine how many other people in Massachusetts can't get the mental health they need. Add to that, you know, the special considerations we have for vulnerable populations. LGBTQ people like me are three times more likely to experience mental health challenges. All of this is sort of leading us to, under the Senate president's direction, really look at how do we transform mental health and truly build a system of integrated mental health care.
You use that word barriers. The ABC in the bill's title stands for Addressing Barriers to Care. So what specifically does the bill do?
So the Mental Health ABC Act treats mental health care as health care. You mentioned parity. And so we get at this through parity and other insurance reforms. We make explicit existing parity laws that have been in the books here in Massachusetts for over 20 years. We give the state more tools to truly enforce that. That means more reporting to the Division of Insurance, explicit transparency, the ability to impose penalties on violations. And then we also look at, in the insurance space, providing protections for patients who have acute mental health needs related to how insurance companies handle what are called prior authorizations for services, essentially the determination of whether or not you're going to be approved for that care to be paid for. If you're in an acute mental health crisis under the bill, you're going to get inpatient treatment without prior authorization. So there's a number of other pieces on this too. Yep.
Let's talk about cost a little bit. For example, one component of the bill, as I understand it, would require any hospital with an emergency department to, quote, have the capacity to evaluate and stabilize a person admitted with a mental health presentation at all times, end quote. That really could mean added staff, overtime hours. We know some of our community hospitals, smaller hospitals, are financially struggling as it is. Do you have any concern that what you've got in this legislation, well intended, might actually raise costs and cause some hospitals or other facilities to close?
Well, I understand community hospitals very, very well because the Cape and Islands District, I've got three of them. And of the 12, you know, we have 12 community hospitals in the Commonwealth. They are certainly strained. We've worked hard to make sure that we're getting the language right, so providing tools for hospitals to provide these services. Elsewhere in the bill, we mandate commercial coverage of what is called emergency service providers, ESPs. Those have historically only been funded by MassHealth. By allowing commercial reimbursement for that, we believe that it allow hospitals to sort of fill the gap in emergency departments. And then we also are looking at other pieces in forthcoming bills around telemedicine, proxy credentialing, other pieces that are going to help community hospitals make sure that they meet this. I will say, though, you know, when you walk in to an emergency department and, you know, you're in cardiac arrest, you know, you're going to get a certain set of services and you're going to get them pretty immediately. And the healthcare system is actually really good at responding to that. If you walk into an emergency department with a acute psychiatric emergency, in many cases, you're not getting the care that you need. And that's sort of across the system. It's a challenge within hospitals. It's a challenge of getting folks beds. It's a challenge of getting, approval for those. And so we're beginning to work on fixing a very broken system. We're going to have to keep at it.
Yeah, I'm married to a psychiatrist and do hear the stories of challenges of getting beds and referrals, et cetera. This law is being debated in the state Senate right now. Have you spoken to Bob DeLeo? Do you think there are chances this is going to pass in the House?
So I've been working closely with my counterpart in the House, Representative Marjorie Decker, who she's the House Chair of the Joint Committee on Mental Health, Substance Use, and Recovery. Our committee is working on a bill that's more focused on children's mental health. I really think that the time has come for us to act on mental health. I think we're putting out a very strong bill from the Senate. You know, we had a rally press conference before we went into the bill, and, you know, we had, I don't know, hundreds of people on the grand staircase, representatives of every stakeholder group in this space imaginable, you know, including the health insurers, including the hospitals, all at the table. So I think we're well positioned to, you know, make some progress on an issue that honestly we have not taken up legislation that comprehensively addresses mental health in a very, very long time. I think that it's long overdue that we take action here.
In our last little bit, Dr. Jhelum Biswas, who is the director of the Psychiatry Law and Society Program at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, had an op-ed in the Globe today that highlighted what he believes is a need to address the Rogers guardianship statute, which has to do with protecting patients' rights to refuse medication. Do you agree with his position, and does your bill address anything about the Rogers guardianship statute?
So the bill does not address that fact, and I've been so busy preparing for the debate that I didn't read his op-ed, but I'll certainly check it out. I think I'll say this, you know, the reasons why our mental health system is broken are many and intricate. Mental health care is treated differently than physical care. It's often not covered by insurance. It's difficult to access. It's expensive, and it's hard to talk about. And so as we've sunk our teeth into these barriers, we've just really sought to begin to do some things in a comprehensive way that are going to make a difference. But there's a real acknowledgement on my part, you've heard the Senate President speak up about this as well, that, you know, this isn't just one bill, one session. We're going to need to come back to this issue time and again to really make some progress to make sure that, you know, people are getting the mental health care they need and they deserve.
That is Massachusetts Senator Julian Cyr. Senator Cyr, thanks so much for the time today.
A pleasure to be with you.
Okay, so when an important bill goes before Congress, the Congressional Budget Office provides an independent analysis of how much it would cost. When a bill goes before the state legislature in Massachusetts, not so much, at least until today. Tufts University is launching a new initiative today to provide what they say will be a CBO-like analysis for state legislation and ballot initiatives. It's called the Center for State Policy Analysis. It'll be led by Evan Horowitz, former data reporter for the Boston Globe and frequent Radio Boston contributor. Evan's with me here in Studio 3. Evan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. You know, the first time I was ever on Radio Boston
yeah.
was a Friday Week in Review, and You were the other guest.
That's right. We were buddies.
Yes, you shepherded me through it. I'm forever grateful for that. So it's a pleasure to be back here with
you. It's really great to have us both here in these new capacities.
Yes.
Right? So tell me, in your new capacity, why do you think the work of this new center is important?
Well, you laid it out already. I mean, the state lacks this capacity that the federal government has. When you're working on a bill, you need to know exactly what the impact's going to be, not just on the budget, but on people throughout the state. And lawmakers here are overworked and understaffed for the most part, which leaves them without the time and resources they need to figure that out in lots of cases. So it would be nice to have an agency dedicated to providing that information, and we want to be that agency.
So what are you going to do first?
In terms of what bill are we going to tackle? So we're already working on two projects, one of them around TCI. Now, that's the multi-state carbon cap and trade thing. Think of it as a big kind of carbon tax effort that's been pushed by the governor and is getting some attention.
It's a transportation climate initiative.
Correct. So we're going to do an analysis of both of the impact on emissions that would come out of it, like what kind of reduction in emissions could you imagine, and also the impact on state revenues and town by town. So that's one thing. We're also working on prescription drug costs and the trade-offs involved with trying to manage prescription drug cost increases statewide.
So I've seen you use some numbers that were produced by the Health Policy Commission in relation to the nurses' ballot question recently as an example for why this kind of work is necessary. But their numbers, the $900 million a year estimate on new nurse staffing ratios and what that would cost, certainly was criticized by advocates as flawed. So can you really come out with numbers that people on all sides are going to say, yeah, those are legitimate numbers, those are credible, and we all agree to use those as we deliberate on a ballot question or a bill?
What I love about the question is, nonpartisan numbers are, of course, going to be attacked by partisans. So whether a position is going to be attacked is not the right metric here. But just to go back to that particular example, it was a very contentious ballot initiative about nurse staffing ratios and how many nurses there should be per patient in various hospitals and whether that would be dictated by the state. And there were wildly divergent claims from the two sides and a felt need for some independent group to do an assessment and figure out where the truth lay. Now, the Health Policy Commission stepped up in that case and I think made a real difference with the numbers, not because they convinced everyone, but because they were a credible voice and people acknowledged. In fact, in some ways, they got more criticism because they were a credible voice doing credible research. And that undermines people who feel differently or think differently or were trying to push a different message. So I do think that example holds. And it's not that we're aiming to be an agency that everyone agrees with. It's that we're aiming to be an agency where people can't criticize the evidence being used to produce our reports. What we'll work with is the best evidence available, and we'll lay out where it comes from, what the limitations of it are, and exactly what we're doing with it.
So how is this center different than, say, the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, which monitors state budget and, you know, topics like education? You used to work there.
Yeah.
How is this different?
I learned so much there. The real difference is a question of sort of agenda shaping and topics. The groups like Mass Budget or like Mass Taxpayers, they have they're very serious research outfits, but they're focused on a few topics where they want to drive the agenda. At Mass Budget, it tends to be kind of minimum wage issues, progressive tax policy. At Mass Taxpayers, it's kind of business tax climate, municipal finances, stuff like that. Whereas what we're doing is not agenda shaping. It's not, hey, we'd like the legislature, you should think about these things, you should think more about them. It's more like, what are you already thinking about? What are you already debating? We want to get you research on that very quickly because you're debating this in the next 6 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever it is, so that you can make better policy, not better in terms of outcomes, but technically better. Better where you're more aware of potential trade-offs, unforeseen consequences, research on what's worked in other states, things like that. That's half of it. The other half is, of course, the ballot initiatives where those groups don't really address ballot initiatives. In fact, there's no group in the state that systematically analyzes the impact of ballot initiatives. And that is a gaping hole because taking issues to the ballot has become a more important part of policymaking in Massachusetts, but around the country. So you get very consequential issues that are thrown at voters with a kind of yes or no checkbox and very little independent nonpartisan work that they can rely on to make decisions. So I think that's also kind of a gaping hole in the policy world.
All right. So you've met with staff from House Speaker Robert DeLeo's office, Senate President Karen Spilka's office. Talk about this work. Are you encountering resistance from anyone at the State House? Has this been embraced by people at the State House? What kind of reaction are you getting?
So No resistance. I think embrace would be strong because I haven't proved myself yet, right? The work we have to do, we launched today. We've undertaken some research projects, but we haven't published anything yet. So there's a kind of trust-building effort afoot. And the way to build the trust is to have these meetings, produce research, see what the benefits of having an agency like mine or center like mine do analysis on live legislative issues could be for legislators themselves and legislative staff. So I think, no, there hasn't been any resistance. And we're working towards, or I'm very actively working towards, the kind of embrace you ask about, where there's just a kind of mutual trust. But that takes time to build up.
Okay, we've got 30 seconds. Just briefly, how are you funded?
So we launched today. So it's a little premature to talk about all our funding. But the idea is as follows. We are going to rely on a diverse set of funding streams because if you're all, say, all back business-backed funding or all labor-backed funding, then obviously that calls into question the number.
Right.
So we're going to have a diverse set of funding streams. And we're going to share all of our funding streams, the information about them. There won't be any question about who is funding this operation. And that's because protecting and preserving the nonpartisan status of this group is so fundamental to its success. If that breaks down, we fail. And I don't want to fail. I want to succeed. So that means being forthright about where the funding is coming from and how we use our evidence and having a diverse set of influences in terms of intellectual supporters in the advisory council.
All right. That's Evan Horowitz, former Boston Globe data reporter, frequent Radio Boston contributor, and new head of the Center for State Policy Analysis at Tufts. Thanks, Evan.
I missed this, Tiziana.
It's great to have you. And a quick note on news this afternoon. The online retailer Wayfair says it's laying off 550 employees, including 350 at its Boston headquarters. Through a spokeswoman, Chief Executive Niraj Shah declined an interview request to WBUR. The 550 jobs represent about 3% of the company's global workforce, a reckoning for the home and furniture retailer, which has not yet turned a profit. WBUR's Bostonomics team is following this. As details emerge, you can visit WBUR.org for more. Meanwhile, stay with us. Coming up, should Boston eliminate rental broker fees? Tell us what you think. Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're going to talk next about an idea that's coming our way from New York City. And if you have ever had to rent an apartment here in Boston, it's probably going to resonate with you. Broker fees. Those are that full month rent fee that can be charged by a real estate broker to rent a unit. And it usually gets paid on top of first month, last month security deposit to the landlord. New York regulators, using a new state law to strengthen rent control there, have mostly banned broker fees. Now, that ban has been put on hold for a month by a judge, but the idea remains there. And the question is, should Boston follow suit? Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's office is actually launching a working group to study the idea. We've been talking about this one all morning here at WBUR. So pull up a chair, talk with us. What's on your mind? Are you a broker and do you depend on these fees for your livelihood? Are you a renter or a tenant trying to find a place and find the fee burdensome? So do you support the idea of eliminating these fees or not? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So with me here in the studio to discuss this is Greg Vassell. He is the president and CEO of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you. Welcome.
Also is Mike Leyba, development director at City Life Vita Urbana, a Boston tenant advocacy group. Mike, great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's kind of frame this up. The median rent in Boston is around $2,400 for a one-bedroom, according to the real estate site Zumper. That means that tenants would have to put out close to $10,000 up front if you did broker fee first, last, and security deposit just to rent a new place. Eliminating the broker fee would take $2,400 off of that, but that's a lot left for someone to pay. Greg, let me just start by asking you, what would eliminating the broker fee mean to your members, to brokers themselves?
Well, the interesting thing about the brokerage industry is there are a lot of unlicensed rental agents that are running around out there. Brokers are members that adhere to a code of ethics. They have a state license, so they're regulated by the state. They help people with lead paint issues. They do credit checks. They are many times in the rental situation work for the owner directly. So they're also providing a service as well. And depending on how the brokerage and listing agreements are, people think that a rental agent may get the entire fee. They may not. They may be splitting it with other entities. So, this is their livelihood. People think that A lot of the brokers make a lot of money. And there are people that may make a sale or two a year and then are scrambling to try to make ends meet and use things like the brokerage fee to sort of supplement their income.
Okay, Mike, does City Life support the idea of eliminating broker fees? And what do you think it would mean for tenants if the city were able to do that?
We support the idea. I think it needs to be part of a much larger suite of protections for tenants. And in New York, the New York example that you mentioned, it was in fact part of a larger tenant protection bill. So we support the elimination of brokers' fees as much as it's part of a larger, more comprehensive anti-displacement and affordable housing production strategy.
All right. I want to grab a couple of calls because the lines are filling up quickly. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Kevin in Somerville. Kevin, what do you want to say with our panelists?
Yeah, my name is Kevin. So I'm actually representing Greater Boston Association of Realtors as well. And I totally agree with Greg that broker's fee would be taken away. The broker's fee would be detrimental to the realtor or the agent's community. And not only that, you know, the agents do not take a huge chunk out of this. They take actually a minimal part of it after showing, you know, 5 to 10 units to tenants. And it's not always true that it's broker's fee, first, last, and security. There are many units out there that just requires first and security. So really, there's always room for negotiation.
I'm going to stop you there. You've got some good points there, and our lines are filling up. I want to grab one more caller before I take us back to the panel. Sorry to interrupt you there. I do want to add Steve from Arlington. Steve, go ahead.
Okay, thanks very much. I've been a landlord for over 30 years. I have never used a rental agency to find tenants. I do not believe in paying a fee that unfortunately is going to have to be absorbed by the prospective tenant. It is the cost of doing business. And with people having to pay such high rents first, last month, et cetera, it makes no sense to me that they should also have to pay a finder's fee. This is what has to be done by the landlord. They're making enough money. They can absorb the cost to advertise their property.
Thanks for that call, Steve. I appreciate it. So, Greg, I'll turn to you first. We've got a yin and a yang there, right? There is a tension between people who may be providing services and just the staggering cost of rents in Boston. How do we think about that tension?
Well, the solution is production. And we need more units for people at all price ranges. And sort of that's one of the biggest things that we face and we've been struggling and fighting for pretty hard. You know, Steve raises a great point. There's a lot of people out there that list their properties directly. So that's an avenue for people to take. And, you know, it's hard and it's difficult for folks to find units that may be looking because we don't have enough of them out there. So, I mean, it's one that we can't resolve simply. And the interesting thing about the New York law and the fact that the judge put it on hold is it's not clear that they even had the authority to prevent those fees in the way that that legislation was drafted. And if it was more transparent, I think you would have had a different outcome and it may not have gotten through the New York State legislature the way it did.
Let me just ask you for your reactions, Mike.
Yeah, I think so. One thing that's a clarifying point is that the New York law didn't actually eliminate or ban brokers' fees altogether. It eliminated the ability for landlords to have a broker to pass that cost off to a tenant, right? So as a landlord, I could still engage a broker as long as I'm paying the broker's bill. And as a tenant, I can engage a broker as long as a tenant, I agree to pay that broker's fee. So the New York law is very specific and it wouldn't eliminate broker fees altogether. That said, I agree that there actually needs to be more development, but it definitely needs to be – it can't be at all levels. Right now in Boston specifically, in Greater Boston, we're developing at levels that are unprecedented and they're not
– Levels or, meaning high rent is what you mean.
I mean
is
both.
Right?
I mean in terms of production, like quantity of units that are being produced as well as the cost of the units.
Okay.
Yeah, last year or last quarter, the average median rent in Boston is $2,350 about. That's unaffordable for most of working class Bostonians.
All right, let's grab another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lucia is on the line from Stowe. Lucia, go ahead.
Yeah, my daughter just got an apartment in December in Brighton. But we looked at several others in Brighton, and they were horrible. They were little studios for $1,600, a deposit, and a broker's fee. I'm not against broker's fee, but I think they need to be half, and then the owner of the buildings maybe need to pay. You're talking about $4,000 just to move into an apartment in Boston. When I was looking in the 80s, I know it's a long time ago, you just paid a deposit, a security deposit, and the rent. And, I mean, it's just, I mean, these apartments are not nice.
Yeah, let's pick it up from there, Lucia. I want to come back to Greg and Mike on that. You know, last year a study came out by J.P. Morgan Chase. It was a national study. It found that nationally, on average, a middle-income family needs about $5,000 in a rainy day fund but only has $2,000. That's a $3,000 gap. And lower-income families need about $2,500 but just have $700. Another study from last year found that only 40% of Americans could cover an unexpected $1,000 expense. So the kinds of cash outlays we're talking about just for a fee do seem like they'd be beyond much of what people can afford. So how does one even do this in the first place? And isn't it time to consider lowering the overall cash outlay for what it takes to obtain housing? Mike, you're nodding. I'll turn to you first, and then Greg, I want to come to you too.
Yeah, just to point out that there actually is a bill in front of the Housing Committee right now, which is a Tenant Protection Act, which enables municipalities. It's a local options bill. So the city of Boston or any city throughout the Commonwealth would be able to finance upfront moving costs over a six-month period. It's based on a policy that's currently being used in Seattle. And you know, it's in front of the Housing Committee, and it will be until March 31st when they recommend whether to send it to study or out of committee, report it favorably. So there is I definitely agree that the high move-in costs are prohibitively expensive for most people, and that something needs to be done to do that.
Greg, what are your reactions?
The costs are daunting, but I mean, again, it's the difficulty that we face with success in Boston. And what we need to also look at is if you look at the city's numbers for production, the city has far outpaced any other community that is around it. So we need to be, this needs to be a regional solution.
Yeah, there you go.
And we need to build in other communities, not just in Boston itself, because in Boston, you're looking at the highest land costs in the entire state.
I say, yeah, there you go, because we've had conversations here with Mayor Marty Walsh. And we covered this with Governor Charlie Baker's State of the Commonwealth address. And this question of regional solutions to our housing challenges does come up over and over again. Lines are full, so let's grab a couple more callers. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Ernie on the line from Quincy. Ernie, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I had a couple of quick thoughts. One is that I think there ought to be a sliding fee for brokers, and brokers should get paid. But I think there needs to be a sliding fee that's it's really linked to how many apartments did you see. If you saw one and you rented it versus if you see 10 with that broker and finally rent the 10th, there should not be it should not be the same fee. And two, I think that I've rented apartments where there was no fee, where there was half a fee and where there was a full fee. And so my second point is I think there ought to be a standard that's agreed to so people know what they're walking into.
Thanks for that, Ernie. I'm going to add one more caller voice in here. We've got Steve from Arlington. Steve, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks very much. So I'm a real estate agent here in Arlington, and there are three things very specific to talk about. One of the things is that a broker and a true realtor, their main job is not to just show the property, but to make sure that the property itself that's listed by the landlord is in compliance with all the state and city regulations. Most landlords sometimes try to bypass the real estate agent because their property doesn't meet certain standards. There's all the things the agent does as far as making sure that the property has a lead paint compliant form, that it meets the discrimination approvals, that it's a legal apartment and not an illegal apartment. And the other thing is that, you know, there are two sides of the fee. There's an agent that's going to represent the seller and or the landlord, and they're going to pay a fee for that. And then the agent that's representing the buyer should get a paid a fee from that buyer agent or the tenant agent.
All right, let's pick it up from there, Steve. Thank you so much for explaining that structure. So what we have here, gentlemen, I feel like we've got this rock and this hard place where we hear people saying there are services that are important to provide, although we've got another caller here who I think we're probably not going to get to who's saying, hey, I found my own apartment and still had to pay a broker's fee. On the other hand, we have this the unquestioning fact that it's a lot of money to lay out, that we are short on housing stock, and that affordable housing is a key issue. So what's our path forward given this rock and hard place? This time I'll start with you, Greg, and then I'll go to Mike.
Well, number one, I think the first thing we need to do is pass the governor's housing choice bill.
To say a little more about that.
That bill is really important because and basically won't do a lot for the city of Boston, but it will do a lot for the communities that surround Boston. It'll loosen up zoning and it'll allow developers to come in and build in communities that have been hostile to multifamily housing and development in general. That's one of the reasons why I think when you take a look at the city and Mayor Walsh and what he's done, Boston has been incredibly generous to development. And as Mike mentioned, and we've done a lot of development in the city. It's time for the other communities to step up. There's about 7 or 8 really big points in that, 2/3 zoning changes, accessory dwelling units, little things, not the silver bullet that solves the problem, but the first step. We haven't had meaningful zoning reform in Massachusetts in like 30, 35 years. It's time we do more for people, and this is the only way we can do it. That's the real political football here is zoning, and we need to focus on it.
And how about from City Life's perspective, Mike?
I think I agree with that broad to some degree. I think that Boston definitely is producing more than the rest of the suburban communities around it. I think focusing on – we cannot build ourselves out of this crisis. And I think
Why
that
not?
Focusing on production is just – it's frankly, it's very profitable, and it's the landlords and the developers' agenda. I would say that the only way that we're going to address displacement and address affordable housing is through a comprehensive solution which protects tenants in addition to building new housing.
What are you really saying here, Mike?
I'm saying that the Housing Choices Bill is itself not the solution. It's not a golden a silver bullet. It is it provides no immediate short-term benefit to anybody who is struggling right now today.
And what do you think is necessary for immediate short-term benefit for people who are struggling today?
The bill that we're talking about...
the Tenants' Rights Bill.
In New York, the bill that we're referencing in New York was part of a larger comprehensive housing solution, which strengthened their rent control laws. And we cannot talk about displacement and affordability crisis in Boston or in Greater Boston or throughout the Commonwealth without talking about rent control.
So that would require statewide action. In 1994, rent control was essentially abolished through a statewide initiative. Is it viable to think that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is ready to create conditions where rent control can come back? What do you think, Greg?
Rent control in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts would be the death knell of housing and housing production. When you take a look at our economy, our growth, our vibrancy, we would be back to, you know, people forget what rent control was like, the quality of units. Rent control doesn't necessarily just help people that are less fortunate. There are a lot of rich people that are in rent control units that were gaming the system. It's not the be-all and end-all, and it doesn't solve the problems here. That would be the step in the wrong direction for us.
So, Mike, you know, in New York and San Francisco, they have rent control, but it's actually not done a lot to curb housing costs. They're two of the most expensive markets. Oregon passed rent control statewide last year, and according to a report from Brookings, overall rent control, quote, appears to help current tenants in the short run. In the long run, it decreases affordability, fuels gentrification, and creates negative spillovers. So why is this an area that you're pushing so hard, given what that data suggests?
Well, you know, with due respect to Brookings, I wouldn't necessarily rely on them as the sole voice about economic policy and in regards to rent control.
Why do you say that?
Because the truth on the ground that we see every single day just does not reflect that reality. Rent control in Massachusetts, it was in 3 cities and towns. It was in Boston, Brookline, and Cambridge, and it was voted by 351 cities and towns across the Commonwealth. So to say that it was unpopular was actually not true. In the cities that actually had rent control, it was very popular. But, you know, it was the real estate industry that decided to launch a campaign against it, to repeal it. And so that's what happened in Massachusetts. And as a result of it, we're burdened with this ridiculous home rule petition process, which means that municipalities don't have the tools that they need to actually address the housing crisis in their backyard.
Okay, Greg, Mike, 15 seconds each. Greg, where is there some common ground?
I think we need to have a bigger forum where tenants, owners, and everybody gets together to solve a problem. Because what we see is these ridiculous rallies, and we spend a lot of energy, and we do a lot of press, but nobody gets in the room, rolls up their sleeves, and really solves a problem here.
Okay. And Mike, what about you? Common ground.
I think it's hard to find common ground when the voice of the people is just disregarded.
So
how are
seeing...
we supposed to enter a room with somebody like that?
All right. So that is Mike Leyba, Development Director at City Life Vita Urbana, a Boston tenant advocacy group. Mike, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Greg Vassell, President and CEO of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, stay with us. Coming up, NPR's Steve Inskeep on John and Jesse Fremont, an 1850s couple that he says invented celebrity. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You've heard Steve Inskeep's voice on WBUR nearly every morning for 15 years, more than 15 years. Inskeep's a reporter and author. He's hosted NPR's Morning Edition since 2004. So when we heard Steve Inskeep was passing through town, we wanted to talk to him. When not reporting, Steve Inskeep thinks deeply and writes about America's turbulent history. His latest book is called Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. We asked Steve Inskeep all about this high-profile couple from the 1800s and why he wrote a book about them.
I got started because I was thinking about the past, about westward expansion, the way the country took the shape that we now know. And John Fremont, as a Western explorer and a guy who was known as the conqueror of California, was a big part of that. But the more that I researched it, the more it felt like a modern story for a variety of reasons. One being that John Fremont, with the aid of his wife, Jessie Fremont, was a self-publicist. Publicity was the point of his explorations. He was going out into the American West as an explorer, not necessarily discovering that much that was new, and he went back and wrote popular, lyrically written accounts of his adventures in the wilderness. And this was all by design because he had been sent there to help entice Americans to settle the West, to settle the disputed territory of Oregon, for example. The idea being that the more Americans moved out there, the more likely it would be that that territory, which the U.S. was disputing with Britain, would fall to the United States. And in the process of making the West more enticing and more famous, he made himself famous. Another thing that makes this feel really modern to me is the way that he was aided by his wife, Jessie Benton Fremont, who found a way to express herself through her husband.
You know, so as I was reading the book and thinking about this section, you know, part of your title is that they invented celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at one level, we've always had
yes,
celebrities.
They've always been famous people, sure.
But there is this sense of them as a married pair of Instagram influencers or a reality TV show couple, if you want to go back 10 years. She was the daughter of a senator. She came from some level of enfranchisement or fame.
Yeah.
But they made themselves famous.
That is absolutely true. She was not the first influential woman in Washington, but the first, I think, to have such a big public profile while also being influential. I was touched that Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker in recent days wrote about this book and wrote about celebrity. And Gopnik points out that what is American about celebrity is the idea of making yourself famous at the same time that you are doing the thing that is supposed to make yourself famous. And Fremont very much was that way. He was famous for mapping the Oregon Trail before he even reached Oregon.
Because of Jesse.
Jesse aided him in writing his famous reports, in publicizing them, in contacting newspaper people. She aided him as his political advisor. She would go and talk with or even argue with senators and presidents. And she turned out to be a pretty good self-publicist herself, who had this narrative of a young woman who picked out this man to marry, eloped with him, and that she had been really well educated, particularly for a woman in her time, and spoke multiple languages and could converse easily not only with presidents but with foreign ambassadors in their native language.
It struck me, actually, there were a couple of scenes in the book where you make reference to the fact that she was sitting in on meetings.
Yes.
That normally daughters of powerful elected representatives wouldn't be sitting there. And I thought, where else do I hear sometimes now about the daughter of a powerful and wealthy elected public office holder sitting in on meetings that otherwise a daughter wouldn't.
There are a lot of echoes of now, and I don't mean to say that anything is exactly the same, but there is that parallel. There is another parallel in that John Charles Fremont, having become super famous, got his name on everything. People began naming towns and mountains after Fremont while he was still alive.
Streets.
His name was everywhere. He was super famous, and he used his celebrity to run for president in 1856. He was the first ever nominee for president of the Republican Party.
So I want to talk about each of them. And let's start with John, since you've talked about the nomination. But I want to backtrack.
Okay.
As I read the book, I have to tell you, the two things came forward to me about John. One, I'm not entirely sure he was actually competent at a lot of things, based on what I read in the book. He declared the, you know, he scales a mountaintop in Colorado, basically declares that the tallest one, not even close.
Yeah.
After wandering around, lost a lot. A lot of people wound up dying a lot of the time because he'd wander around lost.
Yes.
Did you rehabilitate someone who wasn't competent, just famous for being famous in the first place?
Oh, I don't know if I rehabilitated him. I hope that I described him accurately. And it is true that he stumbled into a lot of his successes. His greatest single success was the conquest of California. And I do lay out this story in a number of chapters, and it's really confusing. It's hard to figure out what his orders were, hard to figure out if he followed them. He thrashed around in California. I have concluded that the historical record, which has been a mystery to historians for generations, that that record is so confusing because John C. Fremont himself was confused. So he doesn't know what's going on and commits a series of blunders, confusing acts, and strangely self-interested acts, and ends up at the end being involved in the American conquest in a way that he was able to proclaim himself conqueror of California.
He also ordered the killing of people.
Yeah.
Killed people.
Attacked Indians.
Yeah. And he, the decisions that he made on his expeditions led to starvation, death, personal injury, etc. It didn't seem to bother him.
No, he would go on. And that was perhaps characteristic of some of the people of his age. I also think that inwardly it did bother him. I don't want to diagnose this guy, but the more you get into his life, the more you feel like you're dealing with someone who's not quite right. And you wonder if he was suffering effects of something like post-traumatic stress. What you've touched on is one of the reasons that this man was one of the most extraordinarily famous people of his time and is a little less famous now because he was involved in events that Americans had somewhat mixed feelings about even then, and we have deeply ambivalent feelings about them now. Westward expansion was a violent and destructive act. The United States conducted an aggressive war against Mexico and seized a huge part of its territory, and that is part of the story, and Fremont is part of that story. And you see those contradictions all the way through his life.
So let's shift gears to Jesse for a minute, and then we'll come back to the candidacy, because I feel like it takes both of them, right, to get them there. You might not expect this, but as I was reading about her, I kept thinking about Greta Gerwig's version of Little Women.
Oh,
and
great.
The fact that we're seeing a telling of that story today that couldn't have been told perhaps 30 years ago when the last one was told. And I found myself thinking, she's a woman of yesterday and a woman of today, Jesse. And are you able to tell something about her today that is a different version of her story than maybe could have been told before?
Yeah, I think so. First is thinking about gender roles. In her time, they were almost absolute, and it was considered truly bizarre to not accept traditional roles as a wife and a mother. Jessie, in writing her own life, I'm not sure that she fully had the language to express how constraining that was, but she had a period in her life when it seemed that she wanted to be a boy or to act like a boy. And I don't mean that she was transgender. I have no such information. But I mean that her father wanted a son. Her father gave her what sounded like a man's name, his father's name, with a slight change in spelling. He took her hunting with him. He took her along to the United States Senate. He took her along to meet presidents. He was a very powerful senator who could walk down Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. and meet President Andrew Jackson when he wanted to do that. She finally reached a moment in her teenage years when she went to a big society wedding, found it disgusting, cut off her hair, and told her father that she wanted to just live her life as his assistant. And that was the moment when he was done with his girl acting like a boy and said, it's time to be a woman. And she did accept those gender roles. She did become a wife.
And as you're talking about it, I find myself thinking, if you have a young woman who was brought all of those places, well, let me put it this way. If you didn't tell me whether Jessie was male or female and that this was the early 1800s, and you told me all the things her father did, the places he brought her, the people he introduced her to, I would think, oh, he's grooming his son to be the next president.
Yeah.
And yet at 16, he said, that's it. You're done. You're cut off. So she then had to groom a man to be the next president in her stead, essentially, which was John Fremont.
That's a brilliant way to put it.
Oh, thank you.
And she, not he, seems to have been the one, based on surviving letters, who kept up their political connections and knew the right people to talk to. There was a guy named Francis Preston Blair who was a counselor to multiple presidents and had been a great newspaper man and other things. And when they were thinking of running for president, and I say they because it was almost as if they were going to run, Jesse writes a letter to Francis Preston Blair and says, I'm sending my husband over to you for some advice.
So he then becomes the first Republican candidate for the presidency. And it's a time of great tumult. You've got parties coming in and out. The Whigs are on the descent. The know-nothings are trying to figure out their role. You've got the Democrats. One of the things that's striking about that is that neither she nor he were ethically pure in terms of racism, positions on slavery, immigrants. And yet the parties were not completely clean or pure. Were you looking at parallels to today where the clear lines of what each party stands for were greatly disrupted and it was a time of tumult?
That was a time of disruption. It is a little like our time of disruption. And you're exactly right about not being pure by our standards. We need to go into this understanding that even the people we would like to think of as the good guys often held views that we would consider to be appalling. There are very few people who would pass muster with our current view of race and society and immigration and diversity and so forth, regardless of our politics.
Even slavery.
Yeah, even slavery. There were people who were anti-slavery who were profoundly racist.
Yes.
And the Fremonts were part of that. The Republican Party, though, was founded as the first national party that was seriously opposed, at least to the expansion of slavery. What made this disruption happen and what makes this a really modern story is that there was a big demographic change in the country. We're living through a big demographic change where people of color and various other groups are expanding in population in ways that seem to be changing the country and make other people very fearful.
White people.
That they're, well, we could say white people. We could just say Republicans, because Republicans get a lot fewer votes from those categories of people. We could slice it up various ways. And we now have Democrats or progressives or however you want to describe them, who are fearful of being shut out of power because of the way that the current president is acting and using his authority. In the 1850s, the demographic change that was going on was that northern states, which had abolished slavery, were growing in population way more rapidly than southern states, which embraced slavery. With that growing population came political power, and it became apparent that Republicans had a chance to elect a president with northern votes alone, which meant they could be an anti-slavery party. Southerners found that profoundly threatening and said they would destroy the system if it ever happened, that if Republicans ever won, they'd leave the Union.
You know, you've just drawn a series of parallels. I'm sure from the vast majority of listeners, it's not lost on them that the time you just referred to back then ended in civil war.
Yeah.
Are we in trouble today? Are we that divided?
I don't know that we are that divided. It's pretty bad right now. It's been pretty bad other times. People keep reminding me that the 1960s, which I'm not old enough to remember, I mean, there was a lot more violence in the streets. There were cities burning. There were a lot more direct acts of physical violence.
So it's
hard to predict the future is what I'm going to say. People in 1856 didn't know a civil war is coming, and I don't think we know what's going to be happening 5 years from now either.
So a lot has changed in the work you do other than as an author.
True.
A lot has changed in the world of media and the world of news.
Yeah.
How has your job changed or how you do it?
Oh, my goodness. The pace has increased dramatically. The amount of information that you have to master has increased dramatically. But in that environment, I would like to think that I've learned to slow down, to be a little more patient, and to be a little more discerning about what desperately urgent breaking news really matters. Writing history has made that a little easier for me, I think, because it gets me in the habit of taking the long view of things. What are the things that we really will need to know in more than 20 minutes? or 2 hours. And that does affect your job a little bit. So there's a lot of lying, too. I mean, that's absolutely true.
And how are you finding your way through that?
Well, I think that it's what I'm supposed to be doing anyway. I'm supposed to be interviewing someone, which means I'm asking you questions and I'm listening to your answers. And if something seems a little off to me, I try to jump in. I try to make sure that the person listening gets to hear from the senator or the White House official or the president or whoever it might be. They should get to hear their point of view, but they have enough context to know when what the person is saying is dubious or disputed or just plain false.
All right, that's Steve Inskeep, NPR host of Morning Edition, reporter and author. His new book is Imperfect Union, How Jesse and John Fremont Mapped the West, Invented Celebrity, and Helped Cause the Civil War. Thanks for being with us.
You're a good interviewer. Thank you very much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.